Marisa, thank you for coming in today. I follow you on social media. I've seen you're speaking at conferences. You're embedded in everything out there in a big way. You're definitely doing a remarkable digital edge transformation together with digital transformation, together with all of the ethical aspects of all of these burgeoning technologies. In fact, it's hard to think of where you're not embedded. You're embedded everywhere. So let's mine some of that activity, and thank you for coming in and sharing your experiences with our insights with our audience.
Beautiful. Thank you, Stephen, so much for having me. It's like it's a huge honor for me. I have the utmost respect for the extraordinary contributions you've made as well.
So let's do some catch up, Marisa. Can you talk, or maybe overall, can you break down what you're doing in the different buckets, and then we'll go and mine each one of these buckets, right? So.
Absolutely. And I am working across many buckets, but they all have a through line, right? And the through line really is education, I think, ultimately. I think that that's really what it comes down to. It's an invitation for people to learn what's actually happening out in the world, because just gathering the information or working on the innovations without it. So some of the buckets that I'm working in very much in the just across the field in AI ethics, and what does that mean? And how are we even thinking about applying those in policy? So governmental policy, and how are we looking at that? I'm also working in climate and technology for a and how AI is being used there, and what some of the issues are that is happening there. I'm looking at education, the field of education, and what's happening as well. In healthcare, particularly, how AI is being mobilized and deployed in healthcare. And I'm working with a number of different organizations. I'm working with IEEE, as you know, which is working on setting standards for design and deployment of AI and technology in general. I'm working with on a global alliance right now. It's an alliance between IEEE, UNESCO, UN, and a number of other organizations coming together to really work on re-education of what does living in a digital world mean? Right, what is digital literacy? What is AI literacy? How are those different? And really bringing it in generationally, and also in multi-sector, because what we're discovering, of course, is many of our leaders who are extraordinarily adept at what they've been doing in the world are just not where they need to be with AI, because it's new, it's emergent. So it's not that there's something wrong with them, it's just it's an emergent field. And so how are we equipping leaders to deal with what's happening? So I'm working in education there. I'm working in again, as I said, climate and technology. And I'm also working on, in terms of health, not just physical health, but also, which I think are indelibly interconnected, is mental health. And how AI, particularly generative AI, and the deployment of AI systems are affecting psychosocial trends in different places in the world, and how we can begin to think about that in ways that will hopefully foster more flourishing than fear. Because I think that that's a huge piece of what's happening. So I think that those are really, that's pretty much across the buckets. And then each one of the organizations that I'm with, which are several, are doing different aspects of those things.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot. And in fact, you expressed interest in this AGI sort of constitution. Have you furthered that conversation with some of the founders of that program at all yet, or?
We're just beginning to I'm just begin we're beginning to make connections. But part of it has to do with, I think, everybody in the field at the moment, as you know, is we're kind of going at full speed, at full tilt right now. And looking at the good news is, for me, I have been asked to now look at several different types of constitutions or agreements that are happening from different lenses. And that is very helpful to me because I don't think there is a one size fits all on any of these things. I just, our world is too big, it's too diverse, too beautifully diverse, right? I mean, that's the wonderful thing. And so, how are we beginning to see where are the threads between each of the different kinds of constitutions or agreements? Because there are going to be common denominators. And so, for me, as I'm looking at each one of these bodies of work, because that's really what they are, and they are to me, they're formative. We can't, they're living documents. We can't be thinking, oh, this is the way this is going to be, and now we've solved it. I think that these are, re it's really a, this is where my original training, some of my original training in creative thinking, creative intelligences, multi-intelligences, it comes in very much so because you're working with something that's truly emergent. You're working with something that is going to be a movable object or a movable concept. Or so this is where I think sometimes being able to stand back, that's part of what doing working across organizations helps me do. I'm also working with Digital Economist, which is a think and do tank, but they're more focused on economy, sustainability, and those ventures in the digital world. But being able to step away from each of those and look at what are the common denominators here, you know, what are really the through lines? Because it's important to go into the micro. I think it is. I think it's necessary, but it's also extremely important to stand back and look across, right, how these are systems are playing out in different areas. Western world, global South, right? There's a huge body, huge differences in each of these.
Were you able to read through, just even on an overview sense, that AGI constitution and it provide some initial feedback, or is it too early yet?
Well, I've begun making notes on it. I don't really give the feedback until I've really thought all of those through so that I'm reading through it again. I've actually learned that a tremendous amount with some of my work with the working groups and IEEE. Is, right, is because what you when you're first running through them, you're wanting to make a statement right away. I think the AGI is the Constitution, what I've read so far, is there's spectacular work in there. I'm always looking to see how is this going to be implemented, deployed, and how are we inviting people, the general population in, because it's affecting the general population. So not just in leadership, but how are we really bringing that in? And thinking from the psychological perspective, again, I mean, for me, that really is what it comes back to, because these are systems, they're all systems that are being designed by humans in partnership with AI, with Gen AI. But it's by humans, used on humans, for humans, sometimes against humans. So where do the individual, where do people, right? Where do humans, and that being a wide range, where does that live in each aspect of the document? To me, that's really important. And it's something actually I have to, that's been standing out to me. I was just in Davos during World Economic Forum week, and it stood out to me there that, first of all, there was not enough talk on AI ethics, I don't think at all. There was very little inference to AI ethics. But one of the things to me that is woefully lacking yet, but I'm an optimist. I mean, you know that I'm a dedicated optimist. So is having enough social scientists and ha in working in these groups, working in the area of how is this really not just theoretically, how is it affecting people, but practitioners in mental health, practitioners in social sciences. To understand how are these things affecting us. And I think about it not just, of course, from my own self and my generation, but I think of it for the generations to come. And so I think that that's always going to be my reflection. I have some reflections from a purely governmental response to some of these things. How will that play out and where would that play out because of the differences culturally? And then some of mine I want to always look at deeper from a just a purely human to human perspective.
You know, that's really interesting. Now, you mentioned the IEEE and their work on sort of the ethical aspects, the autonomous aspects, and so on. I used to insert this into my keynotes even recently, but when I look recently, it looks like the project has finished. They published, right? Can you give me the
I
status of
think,
the IEEE
well,
7X series? You know, so.
ethically aligned design was published in, I think, 2019 it is. Ethically aligned design is out there, and to me, it's a springboard. To me, I mean, that project is done, and there'll be amendments to it. There always are amendments to things within IEEE, but that body of work, I think, is there as a springboard, as a foundation. There are so many working groups right now on individual aspects of that, right? And how does that play itself out? So, for example, one of the working groups I'm participating in right now with IEEE is looking at emulated empathy, right? How every chatbot that anthropomorphizes and says, "How can I help you?" and then responds and has a conversation with you is emulating human empathy. Right, or sometimes it's referred to as synthetic emotion, which I kind of recoil from a little bit, which can be used very positively. It can be used in all kinds of applications in mental health, actually, and in Alzheimer's patients, dementia patients. There's a number of ways it can be used in a very good way. And there are also ways that it can really be used for manipulation. And so there's a working group that is focused on what is happening with how emulated empathy is being deployed in AI systems. And to me, that is a direct offshoot of ethically aligned design, because it's beginning to look at how is, right, how do these things play out and where. So the focus, or the foci in IEEE at the moment, in my experience, is it becomes much more kind of differentiated. Which area are we working in right now? And what do we want to be addressing? I think that IEEE is in an evolution as well. I think that all organizations are in an evolution, because what has been, as we know, what has been happening is happening at such unbelievable speed, that I think that there's going to be a lot of reorganization within even ISO and IEEE and how those are playing out.
And I mean, the IEEE P7X series, which is evolving, like you said, it's now getting into the sort of emulated behavior aspect. And what does that mean? I know it's very practical too, though, right? So it's operationalized. It's not just frameworks, but things that you, let's say I'm a developer, I can use, right, to guide my development.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is one of the things. So include so another area that I'm in, and I've been in for the last 3 years, is we have a climate and tech initiative. We launched it at Stanford 3 years ago now, 2 years ago, 2 years ago.
So is this IEEE?
This is IEEE.
Right.
Right, it's called Planet Positive 2030. It's a huge project. It was over 700 participants from across fields, 13 committees, working on how are we using technology, how can we use technology to address climate repair. I won't even refer to it as a sustainability at the moment, because I don't think it's sustainable at the second. I think that we're dealing with climate repair as far as I'm concerned,
Sure.
before we can get to sustainability. So I'm chair of global methodologies global methodologies committee. And what we're doing now is taking these reports, each committee, like one committee may have worked on economy and finance. Another committee may have worked on smart cities, right? How these, each of the oceans and rivers, each one had their own committees. And then we're taking this information that each of these committees gathered the research, they gathered the information on about how are these things being used, playing out, the technologies, the AI as well, being played out within each of these areas. And then looking to see, and now our next step now is how are we taking that those bodies of work and implementing? How are we making those into standards that somebody could say, okay, now we can use this, right, as our guide when we're here? And as we know, with all technologies, there's wicked problems involved. The many of the solutions that we find, end up creating another problem. And we know that. So that's not going to stop. It's just how do we begin to use those and keep relooking to also uncover what could the wicked problem be here? And can we think about that more in advance, I think.
So, there's going to be people in the audience that are saying, "Oh, that's really interesting." And so it's not a kind of unidirectional program where an organization is sort of broadcasting out, "This is what we've done." It's bidirectional. You can participate. So how I think every one of the groups you're working with, basically it's an open platform, right? Where people can say, "You know what? I'm really interested. I'm raising my hand." So how do they get plugged into each one of the programs that you're involved with?
Well, they're certainly welcome to reach out to me on each of the programs that I'm in. Of course, we are always welcoming in new people. And one of the things, and that's essential. I mean, I think this idea of there being a group that's figuring everything out for others, right? For other people is just simply, it's, I understand where that certain areas of expertise that's essential. But in this new context, there's many of these things. We need input. We need input from the people who are being affected by it. We need people who we and we need people across board. So one of the things that I've been doing and wrote about and practiced quite a bit in my chapter, or my, not mine, I mean, I'm chair of that committee, but in the group that I worked in, we had 50 over 50 people in the committee. We actually wrote together with 26 people simultaneously, which is kind of overwhelming, but we did. And it was extraordinarily rich because we had people from all over the world. We had people from all walks of life. We had all genders. We had multiple languages, right? And so when we really looked at these things, and what for me, what that is transdisciplinary, right? It's a transdisciplinary model. And that's something that I focus on quite a bit in my work. Multidisciplinary is just, in short, multidisciplinary is where we take several people and everybody puts in an idea to the problem pot. Cross-disciplinary, where I'm going to think of the problem from your perspective and you're going to look at it from mine. Interdisciplinary is a consensus. We all come up with something and then we agree this is the solution or not. With transdisciplinary, what's exciting about it is you're bringing in people who would not be involved, nor traditionally would never be involved in these conversations. And you're bringing in people to reflect, to give whatever reflections on what's happening in their lives or what they think or what they feel, and you're beginning to embed those in, and or not just embed, you're looking to see how do those things mix together, how do the and you, very often what comes out of it is something that is something you would never have expected. It's not just an addition of things, and it's not just a melding. It's something beyond that. It's really a fusion, and I have to say, it's a very exciting thing. It's very it's pretty it's fascinating to facilitate because there's a certain amount of control that you have to let go of in order for this to happen. But I have seen the results of it be quite extraordinary, and people feeling that they're discovering things they never would have discovered otherwise in the process of doing it.
So this is probably the only interview I've done where you've actually defined multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, and that there's a difference, because sometimes those terms are used almost interchangeably, but there's a difference. So what I'm hearing is that multidisciplinary is bringing different people to a puzzle, but it's really people who are sort of involved in this puzzle in some way.
Right, but they're staying in their own disciplines. They're
Right.
not, right? So, and I, when I'm talking about the term discipline, I'm referring to it as way of thinking. So a discipline may not be a profession,
Right.
right? A discipline may be a way of thinking, but each one of them is adding, but they're at the same time, they are staying within their own disciplines.
Right. Okay, so that's a great description of a multidisciplinary, and then interdisciplinary, you're saying that bringing people together, but they're trying to come to a consensus of some sort, right? Or
That would be interdisciplinary. So interdisciplinary is where everyone's coming together, and we're still going to stay in our own disciplines, but we're going to look and see what's the common, where are the common denominators,
right.
right? It's a Venn diagram, that's really, I mean, I just did a TED talk on this. So I just my last TED talk in April was on this. So it's, that's a Venn diagram. And so we're identifying, do we agree that this is the problem, or do we agree that this is the solution? It will work, it won't work, but we're still staying in our disciplines.
Right, and then transdisciplinary is not necessarily where they meet in the Venn diagram. It's actually all the other pieces. And
It's very, I always tell people it's delightfully messy.
that'd be chaotic, yeah,
Delightfully
sure.
messy, and it's uncomfortable for some people when they first get
Right.
in. But I have to say, and cross-disciplinary is just a it's an exchange, right? That's a different thing, right? But each one, and people use these terms interchangeably, but they're not interchangeable
No,
really.
there's a
And
big difference, yeah.
what is exciting, it's funny because we had quite a few engineers in in the committee, and I had many engineers who go, I've never done anything. They said it made me very nervous in the beginning, but then when they started seeing what would emerge,
Right.
somebody would come in who has no engineering background, but who had extraordinary farming background and understood the effect on some of the technologies that had been y being used to deal with the agricultural, crises. And seeing how those began to influence, and then even the choice of words, because people would go directly to, no, these are the words we use in pr professionally, and the committee would look at it and go, well, that word doesn't really reflect what I'm talking about. And so we would go back into it and back into it and back into it and keep it. It just kept at a certain point. That's why I say I didn't write. I mean, I facilitated the writing of this chapter, which I think is beautiful, but I didn't write it. We wrote it collectively.
Yeah, I can see how transdisciplinary then would identify biases, right? So you're trained in a particular way and your mindset is that way, and you think, and you're in your lane and you think everybody else is in a different lane, and they have no convergence into this problem. They have no idea about this problem, but everybody has their particular perspective, and you have to honor that perspective, right? In their language of identifying with that perspective. And then when you combine all of these in a combinatorial way, you'll get really unique approaches, right? So.
It's fascinating. And it was so funny because we would be writing it and we'd get two sentences done. Sometimes, it could take this long time to get two sentences out. And we would do it, and we would go, is everybody okay with that? Does anybody have any other questions about it? And we'd go, oh my God, we're okay with this. And, kind of celebrate, because what kept unfolding is what was really kept unfolding is the richness of perspectives
Right.
that has almost been really just a hugely missed opportunity,
Right.
right? In this, and it was funny because everyone spoke English, but even people, I mean, I speak other languages, I think you do as well. The translation of the word may not m mean the same to you.
Right.
So we would discuss, what does that word mean to each person? What does this actually mean? And it doesn't mean everybody's always going to agree. It just doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I can see this now relating to this, and I put this in my keynotes, and I tell people to really research it. the original work that came out of Harvard with Christensen and his colleagues, this innovator's DNA concept. But this is my view of the innovators and my interpretation of what they put out. And they have these kind of five measures, like questioning, observing, experiment, associating, and networking. So in transdisciplinary, you're definitely going to get a lot of questioning different points of view. And you should be asking questions, deeper questions about those other points of view, observing, taking the time to listen to those other points of view, experimenting. Let's try an experiment to test that other point of view to see how we can apply it in some way. So question, observing, experimenting, associating. Associating is, what are these diverse points of view, and what are the connect points, and where they disconnect, but in some way they can still converge, and or you can get some novel ideas coming out of it. It's almost like random graph theory, and then applied to graph theory, and then this networking concept of question, observing, experiment, associating, networking. Your networking is just associating with people who are different.
Right.
And appreciating and honoring that difference, but because that's going to give you novel ways of addressing a problem. And they call this the innovator's DNA, because in their research they found if people practice this, this is kind of like common traits of the top innovators in the world, right?
And this is it's very that's very much aligned with like Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences or
Right.
Harvard's Project Zero, right, for creative thinking capacities for imaginative learning. You know, that term tolerance for ambiguity,
Right, yeah.
right, which is a thing. And people either have a natural tolerance for ambiguity or they don't. And if they don't, it can be built. But it's a muscle that gets exercised, right? I
Yeah.
keep and we're living in an uncertain time. We're living with
Right.
these are new things. I keep using the word emergent, but I mean that in
Right.
the beautiful sense. You know, it's when artists talk about what happens when they're working, they're working, they're working, and then something happens, and it was like, oh my God, we never even expected that to happen, right? So these are the kinds of things to me that I think are really important. And when in order to facilitate this, we went very deeply into creating agreements within the group of how we would be with each other, right? Because that had to be established in order to be able to listen,
Right.
in order to be able to hear, and in order to be able to sit sometimes with something and say, we're not going to finish that today.
Right.
We're actually going to think about it for a while, but we're going to re and also not just re cognitive reflection, right? One of the things in transdisciplinary is to have, in my experience of it, is to not only rely on the cognitive understanding, right? What I think about it, but how do I feel about it? What impression, what sense does it give me, right? These are the kinds of things, they're d deep, much deeper ways of reflecting on something, because very often, you know, we see this, it's interesting because all to me, all of it ties in our chapter, we refer to it, you know, it's part, it reflects the best of regenerative design or regenerative ecosystem design. Because in a regenerative ecosystem, every single being, living organism, is required for the entire system.
Right.
Right? And so no matter how different it is or unusual it is, the system is operating. And sometimes things die off, right? And they have to in a regenerative system. They have to be they, you know, we some things get weeded out and but that this acknowledgement that every single one of these perspectives, points of views, and also, you know, it brings in, it invites, and it's interesting because with Planet Positive, we did something that is almost unheard of in technologies. We brought in indigenous wisdoms,
Right.
right? Which is ways of thinking, right? Again, disciplines, ways of thinking. And it goes much more hand in hand with a regenerative ecosystem design when you're saying, we're going to reflect on this, and it may not be a thought, right? Some people might call it an intuition. Other people call it a knowing. Different, you know, different people call it different things. But it's not necessarily woo-woo.
Right.
It is another way of our consciousness. Our consciousness is extraordinary, right? Our human
Right.
consciousness. And so it's another way of our consciousness and subconscious of kind of filtering, processing. And I think that we are in this place because I truly believe that we're in a consciousness revolution with AI. I think that's what Gen AI is inviting us to. I think it's inviting us to truly, it's interesting. What is it? His name was Makoto. I think it's Makoto Nishimura was the first, he was the creator of the first robot that we know of. It was called Gakusoku. And he created it. He was a biologist. And it was right after the Czech playwright had written and coined the phrase robot. And he created this robot in mind, thinking it would that creating a robot that emulate that that it that that it mimicked human behavior gave the humans an opportunity to become more human, to become kinder to each other, to have perspectives, to use it as a reflection, and actually expand our perspective of the world and each other. It's he wrote about it extensively as not becoming a slave of it, of actually not making slaves of each other, of how could we use this to be more together. It's really quite beautiful. I've been writing about it right now. I find it quite fascinating.
So I can see then, if you look at LLMs and where they're going, including even the open source ones, so they're trying to make it more widely usable, and trying to make it smaller but still be very productive, that you're really getting transdisciplinary plugged into these LLM models. And I'm just thinking of a paper, and there was an article on it where they applied something called random graph theory to the LLMs, kind of try to make sense of what's happening. And it's a well-understood area of computing, and it's a well-understood area, the tools are well understood. And then they found that LLMs are doing this combinatorial kind of problem solving in unique and novel ways that's not in the training data. And it just escalates the bigger the models are. Or the more optimized, I guess I would say, because some of the models are smaller and they're optimizing them to perform like a bigger model, but they're smaller. But the novel combinations are and it's taking diverse, different kinds of thinking and producing novel ways of addressing things that we as even humans don't have the capability, let's say, of even coming up with, right? So that's very transdisciplinary in your definition of transdisciplinary.
So to me, this is where it's the comparison for me is the, transdisciplinary can feel very much like putting everything into a blender, right? And then seeing what rises to the top. And that happens in hallucinations. That's what happens in all of these other aspects with it can happen in LLMs. The piece for me that still is, I think it's exciting. That's why it's like people go, oh, you're an AI ethicist. You're always like going, no, we shouldn't be. And I'm going, no. I think what you don't understand is I think that what we have the capability to do is something that is so beyond anything we've even dreamt of yet. If, only if, and when we understand that it's a partnership, and that simply saying we're going to give this to the machine no longer ends up being transdisciplinary if it's only the machine doing it. It's just the machine taking bunches of information. It's one the, you know with you know it's one of the reasons human in the loop. The fact that we even have to have an acronym for human in the loop, I think this is kind of strange. I do. I think it's very, it's like, what do you mean there's no human in the loop? Of course there should be a human in the loop. And if something goes wrong, we need some of the humans, and that's when I go back to the need for psychologists, social scientists. We need humans who understand humans to be in that loop, not just in it. Because an engineer is going to come in and say, God bless engineers, and we need engineers, and they're brilliant. But an engineer is going to come in and say, we're going to fix this. Whereas a psychologist might go, why is this happening? How is it affecting people? What can we, can we think this through now when we go back in? Can we come through it to it with much more nuance? And Right. And I understand that there's a lot of engineers who like, I don't really want to hear about that. And I totally, they're like, not a chance. I don't want to hear about it. And I get it because it's not in their training. It's not what they're trained to do or drawn to do. Simultaneously, I think that this is what is, I think the future is calling us to do, is to do something very exciting, is to do something. It kind of, it goes to Nishimura's dream. You know, it's us to do something that is, that transcends what we've done so far. And it's very exciting. And I think, you know, once we also work out some of the problems, because people keep talking about democratizing AI, because, and what AI can do is democratize education and all kinds of other things. But we can't really do that until we have the infrastructure. So there's, that's one aspect, because there's many places in the world that simply don't have the infrastructure to access, right? This it not yet. That will happen. There's also another issue that's quite interesting, that there are many places in the world where they go, we don't know if we want it, right? And so this kind of and to me, that's another place where I want to be mindful. Whether or not I agree or don't agree is not so much the issue. I want to be more mindful of, am I being colonizing in this way of thinking of things that I think this is the way it should be? Or am I being responsive? And can we find a way that they're not mutually exclusive, that those two things are not mutually exclusive? Can we find a way, can we find some kind of harmony to be able to have both of those things exist? So I think that these are very deep. They're f philosophical questions. They're psychological questions, philosophical questions, and to me, very deeply, they invite the most beautiful parts of what human beings are. They invite like all of the richness of our multiple intelligences, which includes our emotional intelligence and our intellect, and I mean our instinct, and those are actually parts of our intelligence. I mean, we, right? Intelligence is a huge thing. It's not just being able to compute something. Anyway, that's, I'm waxing poetic, because this is, to me, it's very exciting. To me, that's the possibility. That's the potential.
So I want to get back then to, so j I'm just going to maybe give some touch points. So you indicated that the audience, if they're interested in contributing, people can contribute from an organizational standpoint. So IEEE is a membership organization. You can just sign up and say, hey, I want to be a member of IEEE. They've been around for about 155 years, something like that, for a long, long time. Standards organization, they're global. They have different programs, different committees, and I belong to some of these committees as well. And you just volunteer, and then and you could even get into leadership by just constantly volunteering and showing that you're willing to take some responsibility. So that's one aspect. There's another organization called ACM, Association for Computing Machinery. In fact, I just came off a board meeting just before this call with the Association for Computing Machinery. We're about 77 years old. Definitely like IEEE Global. We have all these conferences. We have sub-organizations, which are organizations almost onto themselves that are specialty organizations. We have journals and things like that. And then people can say, hey, I want to volunteer for a committee. I want to volunteer to work in a local chapter. There could be global programs. There, like we put out a code of ethics and we refreshed it, and then there was an open call of volunteers. And it's a membership organization. These are nonprofits, so they could just sign up. But once they sign up, they can get be active in organizing one of the 170 plus conferences, or contributing to different aspects of the organization. And by doing so, you can also have leadership positions as well over time. We show that you're active and you can move the ball forward. IFIP is another one, where it's a federation of organization. ACM is a founding member of IFIP. KIPS out of Canada, the Canadian Information Process Society, is a founding member of IFIP. The same thing. They're always looking for volunteers for their different technical committees and so on, right?
There's codes right? So I've been working alongside with some of the work that CODES has been doing. Also UNEP, the UN Environmental Program, or UNESCAP, right, which is in the Pacific. Many of these also, people can come in and apply to just participate and see where they fit in to begin with until they begin to, I mean, and this is where I think that these are really valuable things. I mean, I'm involved with the UNEP Environmental Program for North America, and we just did a big workshop on strategic foresight and how we are, right, and what does that mean in a world filled with not just technology? Because as many people are like, oh, it's all AI, and it's like, no, it's not all AI. Some of it is is a different kind of technology. Some of it is AI. Some of it is Gen AI, right? There are different kind of categories, but people can begin. There are many, many entrance points, I think, for people, and I think to all audience members. I also think to anyone listening. I also think for any leaders who think, oh, I'm going to let my IT people do that. I think that's a real, and that topic got brought up a lot in Davos, which I was very happy about. That it's no longer be, and they don't have to become an engineer or a technologist, but it's really important that leaders begin to sometimes even just join the conversation as a listener. Because it's important to understand how these organizations are beginning to think of it, and it's going to require all the organizations. There's not, this idea that there's going to be one entity that will kind of gather everything. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to be a series of organizations like the ones you're speaking about, the ones that I'm speaking about, and how will those work together as a network?
Yeah, even the World Economic Forum and Davos are sort of like the forum, but there's all these side events which are probably bigger than the forum, right? And not as expensive, you know what I mean? So, and then I mean, people can participate in the side events at Davos, the World Economic Forum, and because it can be expensive to go there and so on, maybe go to a surrounding community and commute in. Things like that, so you can be part of that conversation as well.
And I think joining conversations, and I also think a very often a big missed opportunity that right now I think will grow, that this will change. I don't like to predict things, but I would imagine that this is the involvement of youth in these conversations, because for people who are digital natives, psychologically, right, cognitively, digital natives have a different experience. They even are actually, even there's research now showing you that being, feeling that wired differently in terms of even, physical responses to things are different. So I think in really involving more young people also is incredibly important, because we're also seeing how many more young people are also on the innovation edge because they can do so anonymously. Right? We've got we've got young kids creating apps, creating things, and mobilizing things because they figured out how to do it, because that's what kids do. That's what young people do, which is spectacular. But how can we involve more young people? Because it is going to be their world, right? So how do we involve young people in this kind of, I call it stewardship. Would call it stewardship, because I don't think it's always about leading. I think sometimes it's about how are we, it's care. It comes down to care. It's like, how are we caring for the system now, currently, and for the future? Because I don't think it can be only thinking about the future, and I don't think it can be only thinking about now. I think it's really the Italians would say la tutta due insieme, right? The two together.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking other engagement areas. So you mentioned the UN. There are so many different areas of the UN where you can engage. You talk about CODES and the UNEP, this environmental program, and they're always putting up, and you're part of that collective and adding thought leadership and your very thoughtful expertise to all of the things they do. So the UN are, I mean, they're open platforms. AI for Good is an open platform. Anybody in the world can join their neural network platform, consume content, interact with others. They have AI behind the scenes to try to match make. They have a free conference. All of their content is free, but they have a free in-person hybrid conference that people can attend May 30th and 31st in Geneva. They have an open platform for entrepreneurs called the Innovation Factory, which people could just apply, and then they'll get a chance to pitch. There's some curation of that, but the people who make go through that curation process get a chance to pitch, and then they go to a grand finale. But it's great that you mentioned the UN as a way of engaging other standards organizations like ISO, or a way of engaging. Corporates have programs. Microsoft does tons of open programs for youth and CEOs and professionals of where they can engage, and they have their own conferences where people can engage. Right, so.
It's interesting. I have a esteemed colleague who is a data expert, and I'm not, but that's his real focus and area is data and data sovereignty, data slavery, data intelligence, and who's been working extensively with UNESCAP on because what are the effects on we do know that data and how data is being gathered, used. Remobilizing things because we know, human beings have on average 187 cognitive biases. That's pretty crazy. Each of us, all of us, including me, right? We all have them. And we can be we when we make those explicit, when we begin to go, oh my God, I have that bias, I now have a choice to actually do something about that. But until I know about it, it's implicit. I don't, I it's un, it's involuntary. It's something that I have. And so this way of can we begin to be so the data sets that we're very often dealing with right now have been informed by data that was rife with all kinds of biases. And I think there are ways of approaching that and looking at them. And it's really important that we do that. The more that data is being used as, it's really data is the right, it's the currency that is being used. It's being used as a currency. And so how is it being used and how can it affect people? And there is with this, the rollout, I mean, just one example is, the rollout of digital twins as modeling, right? In modeling, depending on who can actually hack that system and get a hold of the digital twins data, there's all kinds of ways in which that can be then used for nefarious purposes. And so those are the kinds of things, we don't want to stop the innovation. We just want to say, let's do the innovation in a way that actually allows it to do the most good. I mean, I'm not telling you anything new. It's like AI for Good is one of the forerunners, if not the forerunner, in this work. When I first started in this work, because it wasn't as easily available. It just wasn't. And now it's lovely to see as many organizations that are doing this. And I just, one of the things, I just did the rush right now, the rush to just say, this is this new product, this is this new thing, we're going to roll this out. That's the stuff that really worries me. That's the stuff that really concerns me. I just participated with also XRSI, which deals with, which has been really focused on the AR/VR world and human rights within the AR/VR world because, you're changing geographic boundaries. And what the redress is when abuses happen, because there are several cases already. We don't, we've already seen enough cases. We don't to know that these are happening. And that's happening to children, that's happening to vulnerable populations. And so how do we begin thinking about these things? Because AR/VR is extraordinary. I mean, thinking about what AR/VR can do for medical schooling, right, is extraordinary. And that same technology can be used in a way that is very abusive. And so we want to make sure, like, how we can't be sure of everything. That's not a possibility. But we can certainly do, I think, more consideration.
That's kind of fascinating. And I mean, AR, VR are immersive. The word metaverse is kind of out of disfavor, but still it's ongoing. And you saw the Apple Vision Pro released their product. Consumers can get it, and people are waiting for the next iterations of that. So it's not going away, like you said, digital twins and so on. I thought was interesting earlier, and we're running out of time, but I just want to make sure the audience is aware. As you indicated, it's not climate repair, it's not climate change. And there's this report came out that it's been over a year of 1.5 degrees above, and everybody was saying that's kind of like the tipping point. Well, we're already at least 1.5 degrees above for the past 12 months. So, and you're plugged into that, trying to address it in some way. And you talked about healthcare. So I just want to spotlight again, and you're plugged into that, and the convergence of all these technologies, or transdisciplinary a lens into healthcare, and how do you address that? I mean, do you have some additional comments you want to share in those areas in terms of your work, and then your final recommendations?
I think with climate, I'm just going to say that the perception of what, we're not in a disaster, the thinking of we're not in a disaster yet has to do with where you live and who you are.
Right.
I mean, right now I live in New York City. I have direct contact with migrants, climate migrants, many climate migrants, right? So there it depends on who you are, right? What your socioeconomic status is, your place, your location in the world. So I always ask, like, think the your our perception is where we are. That's what happens. But there are wider perceptions of what of how those the tipping point is playing out. It's actually not playing out for us as badly as it's playing out for people who actually contributed the least amount. So that's one thing. I think in healthcare, the other thing is for people to be just very aware that I think that healthcare systems are desperately trying to use AI to unburden an enormously overtaxed systems, right? The healthcare systems are enormously overtaxed, and that's true on mental health because that's one of the reasons there's so much rollout of mental health apps. It's also happening within healthcare to try to relieve hospitals and nursing systems and all of these. The thing is that the consumer, as well as the investor, as well as the producers, I again would just say, please be very careful. The kinds of biases that are built into these systems, the kinds of oversight, and very often it's unintended. It's not an intended thing. It was not meant in any with any intent. But really being careful on what we are using and how we are using it. When people say, oh, this is all protected, and they don't really know yet necessarily, was that information all protected? And so we want to make sure that that's the case. We want to say who has access to some of these tools, and have they been vetted enough by but by people in the field. I mean, as I said, this one of the things that has been very was very disturbing was the amount of people working on the policies, both the EU, the US AI policy, several of the AI policy groups, who said they did not they had no mental health professionals, they had no psychologists, not one, many of them involved in creating these policies. And so to me, that's a red flag to me of something that I think we want to be making sure that we include. We don't have to be that person, but there are people we can bring in. And I think that's something. And then I think the last thing I would just say to everybody is learn something new. Learn something new today. Read something new about AI. Joy Bullen-Winney's work on unmasking AI and seeing how racial bias plays out or gender bias plays out. Reading and not reading other books about how and resources. And I'm happy to provide those, Stephen. I'll send you a list of things. But I think that I think it's really important for people to understand, and the general population, but especially could because your audiences are going to be more leaders. People who are either investors or mobilizers. And I think that these are important questions for all of us to begin asking. I would invite, I don't want to say should, I think that never works, but I would invite people to consider some new perspectives.
I'm just reflecting. I mean, you mentioned earlier 187, I think, biases that people have. I mean, that's an incredible number. And not just what we're aware of. It's like Gardner's intelligences. There's 1,000 dimensions. It's not 7 or 10 or 11. There's so many ways in fact, where we have this unconscious awareness, unconscious lack of awareness of what we don't even know, right? So it's like I read this piece yesterday where they find that there's two action potentials happening and how the brain, the neurons process, and they get that's an incredible another layer of processing that they didn't even know existed. So from a computing standpoint, it's doing and or, but they said it's doing exclusive or as well, but not in a complex way, and just at a neuron level. They didn't think that occurred before.
Yeah.
So, there's different groups working on LLMs, and they're now applying to see can we make sense that there's communication occurring with insects, and now they're seeing patterns that there's a much deeper, richer kind of understanding that's occurring. Even among insects, or even computational capabilities within a cell, without any neurons, and so because we're very kind of neuron centric, so that introduces a lot of biases, right, in terms of how we view the world, as opposed to other even species, right, because we're very very human centric. So I think you bring up some really interesting questions, but I think to some people they'll think, oh no, that's just outlier talk, but really, you really have to think of all of these dimensions today, right? So.
I think we're being, that's where I think it is really a consciousness revolution. I think we're being,
It's a revolution.
I think I think it is asking us to be revolution is asking us to be this technological revolution. I think is asking us to really stretch ourselves. And will everybody do it? No, that's the, again, that never happens. But the or don't want to say never, but in general doesn't happen. It is, though, we can see how shifts in civilizations have happened when we've seen it in throughout history, right? How, there will be groups of people who will change how they're thinking about the world, right? When we have these enormous overhauls, transformations. And it's not always only the people who are in charge who are thinking that way. It can be really, it's very interesting how the zeitgeist begins to shift, and it shifts in a more holistic way than we realize. And so I think these are very exciting times.
Yeah, exciting times, and you have to definitely participate to really mind the opportunities, mitigate the risks that are occurring. You have to be resilient for sure. And because these are times when resilience matters, right? And you have to be agile. But you're all of these things and more in incountable ways. So it's like Gardner, like I said, there's like 1,000, maybe 1,000,000 different dimensions to all of this, and you're that, and it's like superposition in quantum physics, right? So many kind of possibilities, and it's like infinite. That's you, right? So.
It's funny, I'm a gardener, and I think that's to me that's kind of like it's a perfect analogy for me. It's like, I love all the plants that are growing in the system, and I feel like all of the plants are needed in order for the garden to be full, right? And so to me, this is what is the most exciting part. I'm not, I mean, many people, are very focal on one thing, and I think that's an amazing thing. It's just not who I am, but it is who they are, which is also needed. It's just not how I operate, but it's a very, I think these are very exciting times. And I really am looking forward to seeing what's coming next. I think that the best of people, in my experience in general, in some ways this is the crisis, right? A crisis is a turning point. That's what it is. A crisis is a turning point. And I think this is a crisis that was kind of needed, a crisis in our for us to as a species, Yeah.
I mean, for sure. And in fact, I just came off a private summit. And this was a side event with the World Food Program CEO group and the Munich Security Conference. And I made this one statement, but I just did it last week when I was in Detroit meeting with all these wonderful people. And then in an earlier meeting, very early this morning, and this thing that our whole definition of what a person is going to change in near term, or what life is means is going to change, or our view of a business, of sustainable business, even capital markets, or our definition of education and leadership, our definition of who we are into the overall ecosystem, our definition of what the planet Earth is and the universe, and all of these things are going to change in the near term. And not at 2100. I'm talking 2025, 2027, 2030, 2035. And it's going to be so profound, but that represents opportunities as well, right? So.
Does. And you know, the thing is, and I don't want to leave out the people who I know are just going to react, and not just I don't want to dismiss it, who are going to react with fight, flight, or freeze, right? Because when we get afraid, change brings fear. And when we get afraid, people have reactions. And how do we also be as humane with the people who may be really resisting change? Because I think that's also what this is calling for us to do. Because there are going to be people who just need to say no, I'm not, I can't go there. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to do this. I don't want to, you know, it's, I don't want to, I don't want to. And then they're going to find themselves there. So how do we make space for them as well? Because, you know, that's just it, because it's the right thing to do, is to make space for everybody. But I think we have a pot with the, we have an, we have huge opportunities. I mean, I think that that is what it is. And a part of it is having conversations with this, like this, which Stephen, I'm always so grateful for, because I think very often people go into to talks, or they go into strategy meetings, and they're looking for a strategy before they're really looking at all the extraordinary elements that are actually happening, right? So how can we really think about what is, can I really take everything in? And now, once we've done that, now can we build some relationships in order to make a strategy, right? We go to action plans before we've even done this process. And I think that this is a very exciting thing. It's a very, it is actually a, it's an artist's way of thinking.
Or our conversation kind of generates this idea to me, these questions then, how do we manage FUD and FOMO? So FUD is fear, uncertainty, and doubt, versus fear of missing out. So we have to manage that. How do we manage the 3.5% that can make systemic change? And that 3.5% could be in a classroom, in a community, in a family, a city, a country, or globally. 3.5% can drive systemic change. So which 3.5%?
Well,
Or, yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, this is one of the reasons. I mean, I think talking about it, I think this is where I think this is part of the education that's needed. It's not just in understanding what the technology is or what the names are of the technology. Part of it is really dealing with what are the our basic human needs, right? We have five basic human needs: safety, security, belonging, respect, and love. And when those are threatened, we have responses. So I think part of this is understanding that those are happening. I think we could even build respond. I think we could build very supportive things into our AI systems that would say, right, that would actually help us deal with that's what's happening right now, right? That's what's happening, right? Is, and how can we become, and again, it's not going to happen for everyone. But I think it's calling for, it's calling for new kinds of education that include us understanding. And we might even use AI systems to do it, which is where I think, which is where I think Nishimura, his vision, I don't know if that included that, but when I read his writing about it, it just kind of, that's what it kind of makes me think of. He was he had a vision, not, he wasn't quite crystallized, but he could see, you know, in the horizon something that was possible.
Yeah, and then I guess what your comments then trigger these other kind of thoughts, and there's 500 trillion in global wealth. So how is that going to be managed and distributed? Or Another question that comes up is because we're in this double exponential change of innovation, more change in the next 5, 10 years than the past 2 million years, how do we manage that change and ensure it's for the benefit of all, right? And or the benefit of our ecosystems? How do we ensure that we do critical thinking, we have empathy, but we also have individual accountability and agency? So how do we manage those things in this in these times ahead, right? So yeah.
I mean, I think these are they're huge questions. I have to say, you know, when I speak to venture capitalists these days, and I do get asked to go speak to venture ca groups of venture capitalists investing in AI, particularly investing in AI. You know, my question is always, think about the people that you love in your life. And I'm talking not just about the people you live with at the moment, but the people you've always loved in your life. And how would this being in the world, how would this affect the people in your life long term, not just now, but long term? And some people will go, well, it's not going to affect them because I can put a fence around it, and I can put a boundary around it, and I can keep that safe. But actually, many more of them begin to think about it. I have, in my experience, many more people will go, oh, this is not just about what I'm making money and then getting a return on the investment. That these all of these things have repercussions, and that it speaks to the accountability piece, right? How can we kind of build that in? There is an ROI on AI ethics. There's a huge ROI on AI ethics, right? Not just financial.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different kinds of questions, but then, the people are diverse, and some people don't have mirror neurons, right? They don't have the same number of mirror neurons as others. It's not any, there's no judgments. It's just there's differences. So some people have more empathy than others, right? And
Right.
look
And
at
also empathy, like tolerance for ambiguity,
it. Right.
is something that can actually be practiced and fostered.
I see. It's like the happiness index, right? They used to think that people had a happiness set point and it was immutable and you're born with it. And then they find these monks and are able to change it and they can measure it. And they go, oh gosh, you can actually, through intent, you can change what we
Oh,
thought.
absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a reason that I mean, mantras are affirmations, right? There's a reason that mantras, affirmations, repeated neuro-linguistic programming, right? The more we repeat something, we can actually begin to I work with neurodivergent populations. I actually have spent time with neurodivergent populations where it's a different kind of perception, right? The thing is, it's not necessarily that they have to switch and become neuronormative. It's that, interesting, we can foster empathy in that way of thinking without it being looking exactly the same as someone else. And so it's because there's also levels of empathy. There's I mean I Stephen, I could talk forever, but you know, there's cognitive empathy, mental empathy. There's emotional empathy, which is actually feeling, somatic empathy. And then there's something called compassionate empathy, which is referred to as the highest form of empathy. And that's actually the ability to stand back away from something enough to have empathy without letting it take over yourself, because that doesn't help anyone, and actually do something good with it, right? So compassionate empathy is something that can be grown, you know, even if some even for somebody who does not have emotional empathy, which is that somatic, that like immediate intense somatic sense of empathy. So it's interesting stuff. This is where it really is helpful to have I think to have social science involved.
Right. So it reminds me of this idea of unconscious incompetence, where you don't even know. And then you get some awareness. Now you have conscious competence, but you have to work at it. And then if you work at it not long enough, you do some switching and then you get into unconscious competence, right? So it flows, but it takes a lot of work.
It does. It does. You know, it can, and it's also joyful work.
Yeah.
It can be joyful work.
Any sort of closing comments you want to make, and then we'll close out this interview. So.
No, I think that's the thing. I mean, I'm just gr always grateful to have this rich of a conversation, because, and I would encourage anyone who's listening, anybody who's watching, to begin having rich conversations. You know, invite a conversation, invite the people you work with, invite people in your community to have a conversation about how they think technology is affecting them. Because I think when we begin to also, and how they don't think it is, right? And what the differences are in thinking, I think that the more that we can begin thinking of it as being in partnership with us and how it is part of our lives, the more that the less that we can go, oh, I'm just going to objectify that and put that over there. It's this thing happening outside of us. It's actually happening with us and to us and for us and all of those things. So I think just more conversations, you know, human to human conversations.
Yeah, conversations and nuanced conversations. So it has to be more than a Zoom call, unfortunately.
Well, it can
I
be.
think
It can be Zoom calls. It's just, I think that having more of those, more of them, it's about, and it's not necessarily, I'm going to have 4,000 of those discussions right now and then, you know, exhaust myself. It's having those on a consistent, that's the same thing in any practice, right? A practice is about doing something consistently. It's not about quantity. It's about what is the consistent way of practice. That's actually how a practice happens, right? So it's practicing having those conversations.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in sort of using technology to engage and things like that, and through these virtual meetings. But I've now started to travel and have face-to-face meetings, and it's just better, right? Because you can pick up these little micro nuance expressions and things like that. You're oh, okay, that did. There's something there. Let's ask them more.
And that is what I was talking about. You know, that's the what feels like it's just an impression or an instinct. It's actually our somatic awareness, because our bodies are infinitely more aware than our bodies know things before our brains do.
Sure.
Right? Because that's just evolution. That's just evolution, right?
Don't think we have we met in person? I can't recall.
No, not
Awesome.
yet. Not yet.
Are you going to AI for good?
I'm not. I'm going out to speak at an event at Microsoft headquarters in Seattle next month. But
Maybe on
that's
Thursday, or next
a
month.
in
Maybe in April,
April.
or I see.
In April. I'm going out to speak there for an event. But you know, I love traveling. I do. I kind of toss between how
So we're going
much.
to have a face-to-face, right?
We do. We absolutely do. But you know, I worry about the carbon footprint at this point. Again, those things I believe we'll solve. I just not sure, you know, until we do, I kind of want to just be more mindful of what my carbon footprint is.
Right, or maybe a million peacemakers retreat or something. There's got to be because
There
we
will
are a common
yeah,
face, right?
there will be that time. And I've been dying to, because you're in Vancouver, right?
Yeah, I'm in Vancouver.
Yeah, I'm dying to go to Vancouver, because I've been
Oh, you
wanting to
got to
go.
let me know if you're in
Oh,
Vancouver.
of course I would, but I've never been to Vancouver, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I travel so much. So there's got to be some way of where we can meet up somewhere. So thank you again for coming in, and what a joyful conversation with you.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast. Platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.